Hello, it's Saturday the 4th of November 2017 and this is the Scotland Outdoors Podcast brought to you by the fine upstanding folk at BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen and my companion, Mr. Ewan McElraith.
If you want more information about this podcast, then go to the website and that's at bbc.co.uk/Radio Scotland. And just before we start, I want to say a big hello to the loads of folk I've met this week who listen to Outdoors via the podcast. It's becoming much more common way to listen to it. So welcome.
There's nearly 6 million people in Scotland. What are the odds that you would meet both of them?
No, it was in double figures, so it was quite impressive. Yeah.
Badgers are becoming increasingly common in our countryside and our regular visitor to towns and gardens. But if a badger moves into your backyard, is there anything you can do, or do you just have to live with them digging up your lawn? They're on the move at the moment, so to find out a bit more about these secretive animals, Ewan went for a look for a set with a top man in the badger-watching world.
I'm Eddie Palmer. I'm the chairman of Scottish Badgers, which is a charity looking after badgers in Scotland. And we're in a wee wood on a wee hill in Aberdeenshire.
We're looking for a badger set. In fact, I'm presuming that's the badger set. There's a big outcrop of mud. Well, it's not mud, it's soil, it's dry soil.
A lot of dug soil, yes.
And is this typical badger country, is it?
Yes, it's good. It's a sandy outcrop, which is why they've gone and dug a set here.
So how do they dig it? Do they shove it? Do they pull it out?
They dig it with their front paws, which have great claws on, going backwards. So they push soil behind them, they go backwards.
This is a massive amount of soil. It's huge.
Yes, this is a small set, but three big holes we can see. There could be easily 3 tonnes of soil in each spoil heap. And it's the size of the spoil heaps, which is the first clue.
So is this a permanent habitation?
Yeah, badger groups, which are called clans, extended family, they live in sets for hundreds of years unless they're disturbed.
So you get places like Brock's Den, big roundabout just outside Perth. Would that have been, presumably,
yes,
a big badger?
Broxburn, down in the Central Belt. Yeah, there's plenty of Brock and Brock's names.
So at one time, they must have been incredibly populous.
They were persecuted during the 18th and 19th centuries. And there is a view nowadays by academics that in the early 1900s, there were actually very few badgers left. They were nearly wiped out. They recovered during the 20th century. And, of course, they were protected, really only protected from the 1990s onwards fully, which they are in law. And from that time, the population's gone up.
Because it was dramatic, certainly in my part of the world, in Aberdeenshire, Banffshire. I never saw a badger for decades. And then suddenly there was an explosion of them. They just seemed to take off. Presumably, that was just lack of persecution.
Yeah, a couple of other factors as well, I think, Ewan. One, lack of persecution, but also greater development. So they've been moved about more. They've been moved out from some places. And the other thing more recently is that we believe with climate change, some species are going north. And, of course, we're having species into the south of England from the continent. So badgers have moved into areas where they didn't used to live. And they've also moved higher up as well into hills and mountains.
Could you hear stories about the badgers moving into people's gardens, chewing up their plants, presumably not always welcome visitors?
That's right, yeah. Out of the many inquiries we get to us, we have a helpline people ring in. The greatest number of queries is about badgers in gardens, that's true, and they're split into two camps. The people that want them want to know what to feed them on, and the people who want them out of the gardens.
So what can you do if they're protected? Just live with it?
Well, a lot of the time, due to seasonality in the spring and autumn, badgers quite often do visit gardens, either looking for new sources of food or they're just wandering, because in the spring the yearlings get kicked out by the sow who's got new cubs. And our experience is often they stay a week, a few nights, then they move on, in fact.
Because they will trash a lawn.
Yes, they will. Yeah, I've seen several this year. Yeah, that's right. It's interesting, I've seen lawns trash because they're after earthworms underneath, but the rest of the garden left totally okay, actually.
One of the things that's gone in parallel with the increase in badger numbers is, you know, the sad reality is most of us are only contact with badgers. We'll see them dead at the side of the road.
That's right. They're a nocturnal creature, almost entirely. So the vast majority of the population never see them. They will see, as you said, dead badgers at the side of the road and wonder why they're there. Well, they're there because someone's built a road over the badger's territory. They don't understand that, and they've been crossing the road to feed, as they've done for generations. Especially new roads get a lot of new road kills.
So they don't learn, that's what they've always done. They're kind of genetically wired for
I'm afraid that they don't learn. No, they're very poor in the Green Cross Code, yes.
What about new developments? How sensitive are they to that? Because presumably with protection comes protection.
Yes, well the things work quite well in that the big contractors building roads like the AWPR, like new housing estates, they'll bring in an ecologist, they'll be doing studies on all the flora and fauna, because you know there might be water voles, there might be great crested newts, there might be all sorts of animals and birds, and they have to allow for that. And the mitigation for badgers is that if it's really necessary, then a new set will be built for them, an artificial one, and they'll be moved. And they're moved by being excluded and food being put in the new set. And that's a very skilled job, that, as well.
Is it successful, though? Because I would imagine that's a big old job.
I think the jury's out on that. Certainly, maybe 50% it works and 50% it doesn't. And when it doesn't, the badgers will go and dig a set somewhere else. I mean, you know, they'll offer us a nice new house and they'll say, no, we don't want that. And they'll go a quarter of a mile away and they'll build their own one.
There is a big sea change in terms of legislation and, I suppose, government, political reactions, feelings about badgers. There are massive changes in just a couple of decades.
Yes, I mean, we're rubbing shoulders with them more and more, which I think is inevitable. The difference with badgers is that they have a permanent home. Other creatures, if there's some disturbance, they'll move off and they'll live somewhere else and they'll build a new den or a new nest or whatever it is, and badgers don't do that.
You need to get more footage out there, because we've been watching some of your footage. I'll put it up on our Facebook page. People are going to fall in love with badgers the more they see them. It's just because they don't interact with them.
Oh, I think they will, yes. And going to watch badgers is a pretty good thing to do. And, I mean, some people do find their own sets. Maybe only they go to it, and that's absolutely fine. You know, they can do what they want. But the sets which are set up for the public viewing, and there's quite a few around Scotland, are really worth going to, because the badgers are habituated to people. They've got used to them. So, you know, the people running them can say, well, 80, 90% of nights, badgers will appear. And they do, actually. They're very reliable.
Eddie Palmer, Chair of Scottish Badgers, Clan Chief of the Badgers. More about badgers coming up as we find out how they cope, or come to that, don't cope, as with change.
Fascinating creatures. I mean, they get really, really common now.
I do wonder if you get to stage, you know, last couple of times I've actually walked through Glasgow late at night in the evenings, I've seen foxes, you know, urban foxes. Will we get to the same stage of habituation with badgers that it's possible?
I think we are getting to that stage quite soon. They'll be moving in.
So a fox is quite a slight animal in comparison with a badger. I mean, a badger's just muscle.
Yeah, but you can still live in a town. Yeah. You get rabbits in towns.
Last week in the podcast, you might have heard Ewan and I extolling the virtues of mint in its many different varieties with Margaret Lear in her garden. Margaret grows plants with purpose and sells unusual herbs and useful plants from a garden in Perthshire. She showed me around and introduced me to some of the interesting things she's more or less forgotten she has.
This is good King Henry. It's a native plant that grows in hedgerows and quite often by the seaside. It's a member of the spinach family. The leaves get quite big in spring and they're absolutely delicious. You can grow it in the garden as well, and it's a perennial.
Is there another name for this? For some reason I want to use the word hen.
No, you're thinking of fat hen. I'll show you that. I'll show you fat hen.
You've got fat hen too, okay.
What on earth is that?
This is a mullein, great mullein. It produces a poker-like flower of yellow flowers.
Yeah.
The leaves are actually used against coughs and colds. Uh-huh. Yeah, so it's a medicinal herb. I didn't plant it; it just came. It just arrived, so I've left it there.
Seriously?
Yes.
Because I mean, you know, the leaves in that are like about the size of banana tree leaves.
They are,
huge.
Aren't they? Yeah.
I like this garden.
Good.
It's got character.
So this is a kind of fat hen, which is the one you were talking about earlier. Okay. And like good King Henry, it's in the spinach family. And you see that it's going into flower now, but it doesn't get tough. You can see where I've been picking it. You just pick off little bits, stir fry them, cook them as a vegetable. It's great stuff. It's very nutritious. And apparently it was one of the first cultivated vegetables. They found it in sort of Bronze Age and Neolithic sites, showing that people were actually using it. Not just as a foraged weed, but actually beginning to cultivate it.
I really like this kind of thing. The trouble is that, you know, we live in such a domesticated, homogenised age that by eating stuff like this, people think, oh, that's the woman that eats weeds.
Oh, yeah, people do call me the woman that eats weeds, yes, yes. That witchy woman at Smith's Spray
that
eats weeds.
Yeah, that was the next point I was coming to, yeah.
Yeah, well, you just have to get over it. Yeah. Well, there's a lot more people doing it now than there were 10 years ago. It's much more...
Why?
Not exactly mainstream. I don't know, I think people are just more interested in feeding themselves and, mm-hmm. you know, what's fresher than going out finding your own food and picking it and bringing it in and cooking it?
Do you use any of this medicinally?
I'm not a medicinal herbalist, so...
It
doesn't mean I won't try it, no. I do limit myself. I use coltsfoot if I've got a cough, and I always have that dried for the winter. I use yarrow, which is great to take at the start of a cold, just as a tea. I don't do anything fancy with it, but it kind of raises the temperature and helps to bring the cold out. A few other things like that, yeah. I use the sort of what I'd say are first aid herbs rather than truly medicinal because I don't know enough about the really medicinal ones.
Mm-hmm. Come on, keep on going down your garden.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just going to take a shortcut.
Oh, yeah, you're going to cheat. I'll go around the way. I've got wellies on, I don't care.
All right.
As long as I'm not killing any plants.
Right, this one, which is still in flower now, I have a smell of that. Mm-hmm. People are often surprised that this is actually a native plant in Scotland. It's oregano. Wild oregano, yeah.
And that's a native plant?
And it's a native plant. You find it growing by the River Tay and all sorts of places. And again, it sort of keeps on doing its stuff quite late in the year. Mm-hmm. So this is something I would be foraging at the moment if I didn't happen to have it growing in the garden as well.
Yeah.
So that's quite handy.
I'm kind of slow on the uptake because my hands are so covered in essential oils from so many plants.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
What is it I'm smelling now? I don't
And next door to it, you've got the wild strawberries, of course, which, you know,
the tiny little sweet ones.
Tiny little sweet strawberries. They're brilliant. Just round the other side, there's another one. It's really hard. It's this plant here, and we should see the leaves at the base.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here we are. Just finished flowering.
Okay.
It's a succulent. It's a sedum, but it's a native one. It's Sedum telephium. Common name is orpine. And this you'll find growing in hedge banks and edges of woods in Perthshire and other parts of the country, but obviously I'm more familiar with Perthshire. The succulent leaves are really crunchy.
Mm-hmm.
Even now.
Okay,
have a go. I put it in salads. You can forage it from when it comes up in the spring until round about now.
It's like... it's almost like a slightly peppery, ribless lettuce.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
But there's no stringiness in it.
No.
Yeah,
no.
It's great. So.
But it's got, you know, there's depth to the leaf, so you're actually biting through something.
That's
it's not just, you know.
Yes. Mm-hmm. This is lungwort, well known because of the white splodges on the leaves, which is supposed to look like a diseased lung. This is another one you can use medicinally for lung complaints, coughs and stuff like that.
So this is essentially, this is the idea of the signature of plants. You know,
the doctrine of signatures.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
The plant would tell you what it was supposedly good for.
That's right, but I think it actually worked in reverse. I think they found that it was good for a cough or a bad chest or something like that, and then looked at the plant and said, oh, well, of course it's good for that because it looks like a diseased lung. In the case of this one, it is effective. And the other thing you can do with it is eat the leaves.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually steam them and stew them up as a vegetable.
When did you start learning this stuff?
As a teenager, probably. Really? So been at it for quite a while, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why? What fascinated you about it?
I really don't know. I honestly don't know what fascinated me. I've always been really interested in plants, per se. And it's an interest that's grown over the years. And I could never be bothered with all these fussy bedding plants that just sort of sat there and supposedly looked beautiful, but just... you couldn't eat them or do anything with them. All they did was sit. So I've always tended to favour the plants that you could do something with, even if I didn't intend to do it.
Margaret Lear there, and you can find a link to her and her husband Andrew, also known as Apple Tree Man. They've got a website, and you'll find that on ours.
But there's still some value to the aesthetics of beautiful bedding plants, bringing colour and
cheering an otherwise dull day.
True, that's very true. But if you can have colour and cheer and eat it at the same time,
ferment
I'd say that. Yeah, ferment it and drink it eventually. That's got lots of points as far as I'm concerned. A couple of weeks ago, we did a special programme on air exploring the Inverness to Carlow-Lochalf Railway, which was a fantastic journey. We got a lot of kind comments about that. Thank you very much for that. One of the many people we spoke to along the way was a lady called Pammy Jahal, who lives at Loch Luchart. Now, Pammy was brought up in a Sikh family in Coventry, but a few years ago she decided that the Highlands were really where she wanted to be. She runs an organisation called Backbone and told us all about it.
We celebrate diversity through adventure. So we encourage people that wouldn't normally go out into the outdoors to appreciate it, benefit from it and learn from it and have access to it.
So, Charles, who people?
Ethnic minorities. It's mostly, and I'm going to be honest, most of our work is about 80% is with women, 80% would be with ethnic minorities, mostly from the Asian community. Mm-hmm. However, it's much broader than that. We say anybody that feels that they don't have confidence or access, psychological access to the great outdoors. And again, that could include things like not having the confidence to drive, not having the language, feeling that they haven't got the right attire.
Because of the cultural differences, does the outdoor gear need to be different? Does it need to be modified in any way, shape or form? Or can they use bog standard stuff, but in a different way? I don't know.
So what Backbone does is create a safe space for people to be who they are. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that anybody has to change anything about them, you know, their outlook on life, or, you know, a lot of the stuff that we're doing is about having women-only spaces so that the women can totally take off the hijab if they want to because they're in women's space. Mm-hmm. But with regards to what they wear when they're cycling, we still wear traditional clothing. We help folks to manage the safety of the clothing. So, yeah, you may have headgear, but we put helmets on top of the headgear. We may have bikes, but we tie bits, floating bits, out of the way. We've been in sea kayaks where folks are putting on their wetsuits, and then we cover folks up, and then get into the sea.
Sorry,
kayakers.
I thought you were punning there. I thought you said sea kayaks.
Yeah. It could have. That's well, brilliant. Actually, if I was in it, it would have been a sea kayak.
Right.
Yeah. So
you just modify what you've got.
Absolutely. And what we're saying is there are no barriers to access, and there shouldn't be. There absolutely shouldn't be. There's conversations in the outdoors. You know, right now we're having some key conversations with some folks that would like to be partners with us, but they're challenging conversations because what we're saying is we do not need to change. Mm-hmm. You know, if we're really talking about the outdoors is a very neutral environment, and Backbone is really strong about that, maintaining a neutral environment.
Do you have to, I'm just trying to think, phrase this, individuals coming to you, but do you have to gain acceptance within the wider community who might, and I'm just suggesting might, frown upon what you're trying to achieve?
Absolutely. Without a shadow of a doubt. And that you've hit a nail on the head where a lot of organisations don't understand that is the hard work. The actual delivery part is so much fun. You should come and join us sometime. I'm being serious. It's a laugh a minute.
Would we be allowed to?
Yes, you would be. Yes, you would be.
Okay. Because we're men, rather than
absolutely.
Else.
You would be allowed to. We would brief folks to begin with. You wouldn't be able to take photographs, but you most certainly could have conversations, and they would love that.
Really?
And so, yes, the hard work is community development, it's outreach work. I've got an advantage compared to, because the majority of the environmental sector in Britain and in Scotland is white. Went out yesterday, I'm a Sikh, you can see that, I'm an Indian woman. I go into the communities and hopefully I don't disrespect anybody. I have a basic understanding of what's acceptable and what's not. But more importantly, I genuinely want everybody to be who they are. And the community's accepted me for being who I am. Most of the community know that I live here on my own. Most of the community know that, you know, I have an independent life and that I live the life that I do. And all the community know that I offer fantastic opportunities and experiences for folks that wouldn't normally get it unless we can provide that space. We did a project where we brought different generations of Asian women together through the environment. So we chose themes like woods, fire, singing, dance, water. And we asked the different generations to say, well, what does this mean for you? Well, wood meant for the first generation, the older generation, food on the table, hot food on the table, because we need a fire to get our food going. And they knew instantly and immediately, put the young ones to shame, these women in their traditional dress got that fire going in minutes. And the young uns were just going, oh, God, don't get me dirty. Don't get me dirty. I don't want to touch that wood. I can't split that wood. Do you know? And they were right in it. Yesterday, in the rain, climbing wall, two young women, young girls in their hijab, doing the climbing, dressed in pink, in the rain. Mum's there going, go for it. I'm talking to their grandma. I said, go, girls, go, girls. She goes, they're my granddaughters, they are. Proudly telling me, they're my granddaughters. So have they got issues with it? Nah.
Are you having...
It's the environment we create.
It's all very well to have an experience, but have you got people hooked in it? People that have turned their back on you and they don't need you anymore. I'm up in the hills now.
We do events, but our main core is we train leaders to take the skills, qualifications and the tools to build their own environmental projects back for their own communities. And they're hooked. And not only are they hooked, their communities are hooked. And, you know, I can take you to so many community organisations where I can, if I give you an example, we've trained women in cycle leadership, cycle trainers, so they can train their own people to become cycle ride leaders, bike maintenance, they've fundraised, purchased their own bikes, and now they're delivering women's biking projects, completely sustainable, in their own communities. And, you know, the women... they're gagging for more. So, and we've had our trainees that have gone through their hill and moorland training. They're going to go and do their mountain leaders. They've gone and done their outdoor first aid, and they're knocking on my door. Just this morning from yesterday's event, I've had three emails going, when's the next women's leadership programme?
That's such a clever approach, because, I mean, it's essentially what you could do, and probably the wrong way to do it, would say, right, you know, here's a kit of parts, etc., and this is the way you do it. You're not doing that. What you're saying is, here's a series of tools, now take it away and use it in such a way that it makes sense for your community. It's not one size fits nobody. It's, you know, here's the parts. You jig them in a way that's comfortable to you.
Yes, and that's it. And, you know, my background is all in mainstream outdoor education and has been for over 30 years, and that is my biggest frustration in the outdoor industry. I'm sorry, but, you know, it is what's expected is that our communities go to conventional providers and fit into a conventional way of doing things. What we're saying is exactly what you said. You now have the skills, tools, outdoor first aid, you have the safety knowledge, the awareness to deliver activities safely and appropriately that meet the needs of your community.
When will you be able to sit out the front there and look at that view with a cup of tea beside you and say, my work is done?
I'm so there. I'm so there. And my board, our board, we just had a board meeting yesterday, and I said, you know, we are in the process of doing a massive evaluation calling Changing Landscapes. A significant part of our work is done. If you look now, go to community organisations, particularly the Central Belt, but around Scotland, you will notice that community, grassroots community organisations are now putting the environment onto their agenda as part of their constitution. They are changing the way they are working with groups to include the environment. There's a strong emphasis on that. They're pulling down funds to do that. And they're getting jobs. And that is a direct result of our work since we've been here in Scotland in 2007. So we're now we're going to capture all that to show that the impact back in Scotland. We really have changed the landscape of Scotland.
Pammy Jahal there, and that organisation called Backbone, I would like to go out with that just to see it. Be interesting.
Just inspirational. I mean, it's probably the best half hour I've had for a long time. You can't listen to it for hours. It's just great. Yeah.
You're listening to the Scotland Outdoors podcast from BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElroy.
Yes, we love hearing where you listen. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, or you can write to us, Out of Doors, Beechgrove Terrace, Aberdeen, AB15 5ZT, in the UK.
Earlier in this podcast, we heard from a guy called Eddie Palmer, chair of the Scottish Badgers, or as I prefer to call him, clan chief of the Badgers. The animals were once under serious threat of extinction, but now they enjoy legal protection. Their numbers have improved, which is all good news, but if you're trying to build something like a massive bypass, like the Aberdeen Western Peripheral Route, and you've got badgers on that route, how do you do it? Ewan gained exclusive access to part of the site with project ecologist Peter Gilchrist.
We're next to Bogenjoss Burn, which is a burn that had to get realigned for the construction. It's got some culverts on it, which are specially adapted for wildlife passage.
Because that's the reason we're here, because you're in charge of minimising the impact on wildlife. Because you've got 58 kilometres of new road, it's inevitably going to impact on wildlife. Let's start with culverts, because culverts, pipes, are really bad in flooding for things like otters.
Yes, correct. Culverts can flood and otters can drown, or they can not use them and then get onto the carriageway. So for the Aberdeen Western Peripheral Route, we've specifically had them designed with wildlife management ledges, which are above the predicted flood events, so that there will always be safe wildlife crossing points.
This is a busy wee place. We've got kind of traffic coming past us at the moment. Oh, it's gone quiet. Thank goodness for that. Badgers. Aberdeenshire is well known for its badger population. Been hugely successful in recent years. Yeah. This must have been a bit of a worry. You've got a dual carriageway going, you know, right across the territory.
Yeah, absolutely. A huge consideration for us are the badgers that were affected by the project. We've got 100 different sets being affected.
That's a lot of badgers.
It is. There's 15 clans. They're not all the main sets, but 15 clans affected. And they were a real material consideration for us, both in terms of being able to keep the animals safe during the construction and, as importantly, during the operation as well.
Well, how do you keep them apart? Because it's a double-headed problem. A badger and a dual carriageway is bad for the badger, but it's also very dangerous for drivers. How do you stop them interacting?
Well, we've got a number of different strategies. One is a physical barrier, so we've got mammal...
Is this fence we're beside it at the moment?
Absolutely, yes. So the mammal fencing, which have special mesh that they can't climb and overhangs so that they can't get over it, and it's buried so that they can't tunnel under it as well. So that's one mechanism. We have special passage points, not only the wildlife bridge, the first in Scotland, but also dry mammal underpasses, and all the culverts and water crossings have been specially designed to facilitate mammals getting from one side to another.
Well, we'll say the culvert at the moment. We'll come back to the bridge in a second. Just talk me through that, because it's got that big ledge. Is that what they walk along it? It's about 6 feet above the water.
Under normal circumstances, an otter will use the culvert directly, but obviously when it's in flood or in spate, it becomes dangerous for them, and what they would normally do in that situation, if the ledges weren't there, is actually come onto the carriageway, and that's when you have fatalities.
So they would prefer to go along the ledge. They don't want to go in the carriageway.
They don't want to go on the carriageway.
Take you back to the bridge. First wildlife bridge in Scotland. That's quite impressive.
It is, absolutely.
How does it work?
Well,
because it looks like a normal bridge with grass on it.
Well, it is. As you can see at this particular occasion, our other strategies for tunnels and culverts don't work here. We understood how important the two forest sections that would be bisected by the road.
Because you've cut their territory in half and you're giving them a bridge. Will they use it? Will it work?
Absolutely will work, yes. It's, as I said, we understood the ecology of the badgers and the other animals that were using it, and they're well used recognised in Europe, has been very successful.
What about the actual sets? Because inevitably, you've got 60-odd kilometres, it's really wide. You're going to be going through a set. There's a fair chance you're going to come in contact with a set.
Yes, absolutely. And we've had to move 15 main sets from the direct path of the carriageway.
So how do you do that?
Well, it's a long, involved process. For this project, it took 3 years of ecology studies to understand both the territories and how the animals use the landscape and the habitat before you can even start thinking about where you might put a replacement set for them.
So do you just dig a pile of earth tunnels? And you know,
well, the first thing is to understand their actual territory so that you must always put a replacement set within the clan's existing territory. They aggressively defend that territory, so if you try to put a new clan into a different territory, that wouldn't work. And the sets then are designed based on the understanding of the clan that uses that particular set that's going to be destroyed.
But if you're making it out of concrete, badgers like earth, soft earth.
Well, we've had an awful lot of advice from the likes of the Grampian Badger Group, and it's well recognised that replacement sets are very successful. And you're right, they're not that enticing in terms of when you say they're built out of concrete, but in fact, badgers actually use very hard, dry earth, and what that makes them comfortable is the bedding that they then bring into that. So when we first design the sets, we make sure, for instance, that their tunnels are soaked down so they don't get waterlogged. We try and ensure that they're on the lee of the area where we're constructing them, and then we'll also put bedding in ready for them so that it's softened, and so it's a home from home from them.
It's a lot of work. Worth it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely worth it. Yes, I mean, badgers are a beautiful animal there, and they're part of the Scottish natural heritage and very important.
Ecologist Peter Gilchrist there.
Amazing stuff. Huge amount of work that you don't really notice. We were rammed it home to me. I was driving up the A9, all 3.5 hours of it from Perth to Inverness. And the new sections, you can actually see all the fencing if you look for it, to keep the badgers funnelled into the badger underpasses and things like that. A huge amount of work to protect the animals that you don't automatically realise is happening.
Yeah. Great thing about working on this programme is getting to see projects from inception right through to fruition. Back in 2014, before the Glasgow Commonwealth Games, I went to visit a site that was earmarked for transformation into a forest park not far from the Athletes' Village. Went back again about 18 months ago. Earlier this week, I was back for a third time and I really couldn't believe the difference. As Forestry Commission project manager Colin Peacock showed me round.
This is the Cunnagar Loop site, which historically, going back into the 18th century, was the site of the first Glasgow waterworks, and water was taken from the Clyde, purified and piped into the city. But soon after that, the city and industry grew up round about it and the water wasn't of the right quality, so that's when Loch Katrin came into play. That left sort of big reservoirs which were dug out and quarried for sand and gravel, which left an even bigger hole, which was then landfilled through the early part of the 20th century, maybe up to about the 60s. So when we first got involved in the site, it was green, there was some trees and shrubs on it, but there was also underfoot a lot of glass, rubble, and bits of metal and all sorts. Superficially it looked quite pleasant, but actually it was quite a rough place and not that attractive to people.
What was the quality of the soil like?
A real mix from no soil whatsoever to disturbed soil that had bricks, glass, rubble, metal all the way through it. So legend has it a lot of the gorbals was knocked down, a lot of the tenement building material came here, and we actually did find a lot of big sandstone blocks that looked like it could come from that. So it wasn't sort of prime tree-grown country, if you like, though there was a lot of shrubby trees and willow and small trees, but we'd be limited to the variety we could have planted in that soil.
As a forester, how do you approach that? Is it with a sense of trepidation or, well, here's a challenge?
Well, it is a challenge, and it's one that Forestry Commission has worked on over the last 10, 20 years, taking on former open-cast coal sites, former landfill sites, and restoring it in a way that we can grow trees. So there is a bit of knowledge and science built up there, but every site's different, and this site was different again. One of the good things about it is you can create a bespoke soil, and that means you can almost plant any tree you like. So normally we're used to digging a soil pit, seeing what soils we have, and then planting the right tree in the right soil. Here it's a kind of reverse, where you actually create the right soil for any tree.
How do you do that? Where do you get it from?
Well, here we did a series of operations. One, dug down into the subsoil, or what was left of the subsoil, and usually used a big rake type thing on the end of the excavator, dug through that, and that was able to sort out some of the big lumps of metal, wood, brick, rubble, get rid of that. So that created a loose subsoil. The key thing was that they didn't compact that again, so it create that airy soil. And then we brought in subsoil, compost, and sort of mixed it up like in a giant mixing bowl using the excavators, and again mixing it together but also getting air into it. And then that was placed on top of the sieved subsoil, if you like, to create a new soil layer from topsoil down to the subsoil.
So essentially what you were doing is what a gardener would do on a potting bench.
Yes.
But on a huge scale.
Huge scale. But this also had a secondary purpose here. Because of the landfill history, we weren't sure what was really buried underneath here. And we didn't want to dig down and find out. So again, the boffins that, and the engineers that helped us design the place showed us that if we covered the old layer with a new layer of soil, that would be enough to protect members of the public using the site. So we're actually, where we're walking just now, there's a probably 3 metres down to the old surface. There's other areas where that depth varies, depending on how publicly accessible it is. In a way, it had to perform better as a protective surface than a tree-growing surface, but happily it does both quite well.
I came here first before the Commonwealth Games, and I came just after the Commonwealth Games, and it's astonishing how quickly it's developing. I mean, there's lots of hawthorn trees, because obviously the leaves are off them, but the berries are just red. I haven't seen field fairs with us yet, but you've got flocks of them passing through here at the moment. What all tree species have you planted?
We've planted a mix. We have silver birch, we have Scots pine, fruit trees. We did have a history of some apple trees on the site because of the landfill background, so we've planted a blossom area with fruit trees.
So where there was rotten apple cores, basically trees grew.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. There's a few exotic conifers as well that we've planted in just to give a bit of winter interest. So there's a real mix, oak as well, beech, all that's in there, and it'll give a real mixed woodland and a real parkland feel. And we've been able to retain some of the old trees as well, some of the more characterful willows, patches of the hawthorn you mentioned. So there is that continuity from the previous scrub woodland.
Now, it's interesting. I mean, aside from that, you've got, you know, play park areas, you've got activity areas, you've got benches all around about the place, you've got sculptures, you've got a little cafe back there. This is a place that's intended to be enjoyed. Yeah. You know, it's not just a tree nursery.
No, so on the site, there's a lot of forestry knowledge put into it, a lot of engineering knowledge, a lot of science as well, a lot of big work with machines and excavators, that sort of thing. But we all knew at the end of the day what it was all about was getting people involved and people using the site. And if they didn't do that, then the project wouldn't be a success.
Waste of time.
So we found from our early opening weekends, come and try weekends, we did have a lot of people visiting, and we had estimates of maybe over 100,000 visitors, and pleased to say that's the target we've reached, and probably even more than that. So on a busy summer's day during the school holidays, it is really busy. Even other days as well, we've got nursery groups using the site, school groups, a local gym uses the gym equipment out here for their exercise. You know, it's all been used in the way it was designed to do, which is really pleasing, because you can never guarantee that that will happen. But it does show that if you design it well and it's in the right place, then people will come.
Last time I was here, this was not here. Now, I've seen this from the other side of the river, but not from this side. This essentially ties the Cunningar Loop to what was the Commonwealth Athletes Village.
That's right. So this is the bridge from the former Athletes Village over the Clyde into Cunningar Loop itself. So Cunningar Loop's a bit of a peninsula in the Clyde. Yeah. So this has been a crucial link, because we've found that the visitor numbers have increased substantially once the bridge was in place. So this has been a great piece of work. This was done by our partners Clyde Gateway and Glasgow City Council.
It's 4 years since I started coming here. So it is astonishing how much it has greened up since then and filled out. Another 10, 15 years. You must be quite enthusiastic to see that.
Definitely. I mean, I think we're quite lucky because we had some mature trees here from before. So that adds to the character as well. So has been a completely clear site. Also, unusually for a forester, I'm used to planting trees maybe ankle height, knee high at the most. But here we've actually planted big standard trees, which we don't usually do.
Bit of a treat professionally.
Yeah, in some ways, a bit more challenging, but good. But that way we could actually get quite a mature feel to the park quite quickly. It already feels like a park that's been here for a decade rather than just a couple of years.
Colin Peacock from the Forestry Commission there at Cunningar Loop. And one of the things I noticed, and I said, look, you know, don't take offence at this, I'm not saying this because it's in Glasgow, I can't see any graffiti in this park, I can't see any vandalism. Aha, he says, come with me. There's a waste bin, metal top, wooden sides and what have you. Somebody had written their name on top of the waste bin. There's your graffiti. He says, and look underneath the metal lid, and it had been chewed away by grey squirrels so it can actually get inside. And the staff apparently in the park are terrified of opening the bins in case the squirrels jump out.
I think I've got a couple of squirrel boxes, you know, squirrel boxes, clever things, glass panel, you can see the peanuts, and they learn to lift the lid and take them out. Now, the blue tits have been watching this, and there's a wee gap at the top, and they can now climb through the gap and they sit inside the box, having an absolute field day with the nuts. And then they kind of squeeze their way. I've been trying to film it. Every time I'm trying to film it, they've flown away. But they actually physically climb into the nut box.
You use your camera trap.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, just a thought. Sadly, that's all we've got time for this week. To finish, we've got a fantastic soundscape recorded by our audio engineer, Ron McCaskill, to mark Bonfire Night on the 5th of November. From all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thank you very much for listening, and we'll be back in the car park next Saturday.